Welcome to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber Podcast, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Network. Take your first step into a larger world by checking out the network on the web at starwarscommonwealth.com, on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. Everyone, welcome back to Journals of the Willing, our bi-weekly or twice monthly, whatever the math works out to be, look at Star Wars on the printed page. Thank you all for being with us this week. And let's say hi to Steve. What's going on, man?
Hey, Kyle. Not much, like I was saying earlier to you. Prepping for the snow. New York's supposed to get it. Kind of bad, so we'll see what happens. What's going on with you?
Busy week. A little bit of an overwhelming week. I've been silent on social media once again, and I do apologize for that, but sometimes life kicks you in the face, and you gotta dust yourself off and keep moving on. And we're doing that here, we're gonna talk about Tarkin today. But before we get there, we gotta talk about the news that was just dropped on our heads earlier this afternoon. Talking about Dr. Aphra crossing over with the main Star Wars title in a 5-part series called The Screaming Citadel. Now, Steve, I think you've kind of been reading Dr. Aphra a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I really only had the chance to read the first issue. My comic book store is stuck on back order with number 2, so I kind of got stuck. I have 1 and 3, but I can't read 3 until I get 2, so I'm kind of stuck in limbo there. But it was a good introduction. I'm enjoying it so far. I really like the character from the Vader series, so we'll see what happens with this miniseries. When is it supposed to start? Did they say in the article?
I'm just reading it again here. So it kicks off with a one-shot.
Probably.
Oh, sorry. In May. Here we go. There it is. Okay. So still a couple months off.
Now, is it being structured like Vader Down was, or is it like its own miniseries? Do they clarify that, or is it just kind of a built-in arc where it'll be like one issue Aphra, one issue Star Wars?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like Vader Down, it was. I think Vader Down started with. Did it start with its own one shot?
It had, yeah, Vader Down number 1 was a one-shot, yeah.
Yeah, and so the same thing here. We'll get The Screaming Citadel in May, and then I guess from there it will pick up whether in Aphra or the main title, and it'll go back and forth for 5 issues.
I mean, it makes sense that they would do it that way. I mean, that's what they did with Vader Down. Aphra met the main crew from Star Wars, and then I think she hung around a little while in the Star Wars story after Vader Down ended, and then she ended up back over at Vader until that ended. So it makes sense that she'll re-meet our heroes.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of wormed her way into a lot of fans' hearts. And people really fell for this character, and I was shocked that they decided to give this character her own title. I didn't know that she was this popular throughout fandom. But here we are.
Yeah, and she's starting to pop up in other media as well. There's that new Star Wars mobile game. What's it called? Force Arena? Yeah. And she's a playable character.
Is that sort of like a scrolling fighter game, like Mortal Kombat style?
No, it's like a turn-based, almost like a Final Fantasy.
Okay.
You get like a... Well, actually, is that... maybe I'm getting it confused with the other one. There's been a couple of mobile games. This one... I want to say... Yeah, I think I'm getting confused. Yeah, I mean, it's turn-based. They've had a couple. And I think it runs just about the same, where you get a team of heroes and villains, and you kind of take turns with each of them teaming up.
That's interesting. Well, there you go. I mean, this character seems to be gaining in popularity almost every day.
Yeah, I'm actually opening up on my my phone now just to kind of take a peek at it, and she's actually on the load screen. So she's like front and center.
I wonder if this all leads one day to some inevitable appearance of Aphra on screen, whether in Rebels or some kind of spin-off movie. I wonder if she'll turn up in the Han Solo book. Or sorry, the Han Solo movie.
That'd be interesting. I mean, as far as timeline goes, she... Well, let's see. The Vader series in the comics, that's in between 4 and 5. So she'd be a little younger. But I mean, I'd say she's probably about the same age as Han, maybe a little younger than him. So it could work.
Yeah, and it'd be funny to have an archaeologist in the Han Solo movie, formerly portrayed by Harrison Ford, who, in another costume, is an archaeologist.
Very meta.
That's a bit of a reach, but there you go. the story sounds kind of cool. It's taking place at an infamous castle located on the edge of space, as Lucasfilm describes the Screaming Citadel. And then Jason Aaron frames it as a, quote, gothic horror story. So I think that's probably right up your alley.
That sounds amazing. for listeners that don't know, after Star Wars, my other favorite genre of films, horror, anything horror. So to see the two mix, even if it's a little bit in the comics, that's like a dream come true. I think you guys were talking about horror either on the last episode or 2 episodes ago. It came up, yeah. I don't remember if there was a horror story. I didn't get a chance to read it yet, but there was that creature novel that came out either last year. It was like a collection of short stories. One of them was like High Noon on Jakku, and it seemed like each story was like a different genre. So like High Noon on Jakku was like a Western. I forgot what it was called, that book.
Is that like a Constable Zuvio story?
I think so, actually.
Poor guy.
I mean, he got something. I mean, I know he got cut from the film. What, did he have a full scene that was cut and they just never put it on like the special features?
I guess. It's almost like they're trying to scrub him almost. I mean, if he is in that book, then maybe I guess they feel differently. But yeah, he is actually in one shot in The Force Awakens as Rey and Finn are running through the market on Jakku. If you freeze it right in the right spot, you can see Constable Zuvio.
Okay. I see. I have to look it up, the screenshot of it. He must have had a longer scene.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure there's a whole sequence somewhere of poor Constable Zuvio.
I mean, I just feel bad for the collectors that bought all the toys of him, and then he never ended up being in the movie.
He's going to go down in history as maybe the greatest peg warmer of all time. Maybe along with Rick Oley from The Phantom Menace.
Oh, man.
I think I probably have 3 of him. 2 of them given to me by my grandmother with like $1 price tags on it. But anyway, so Aphra, Luke, they're going to get together in this book. Not necessarily in that sense. Although I've seen people talking about that. Aphra is now definitely Rey's mom in some circles. Because she's running around with Luke. You had to know that was going to happen.
Of course.
Even I made the joke, but I mean emphasis on joke. This is still well before Rey is even close to being born.
Well, right. She'd be much older if that were the case.
Yeah, exactly. And or unless... you know what? I don't even want to entertain it. But, yeah, suffice it to say, Luke and Aphra would have to be a thing well after the end of Return of the Jedi.
Right. And that's assuming Aphra exists that long in the exactly. series, you know? If she lives that long.
She seems to often be on borrowed time.
Right. There were a lot of close calls.
Vader thinks she's dead, right?
Exactly. So there were a lot of close calls already in the 25 issues of Vader. Now, with Aphra, we'll see where it goes.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, this book, of course, it's going to bounce back and forth between two titles, and so you can expect from the write-up here, Han and Leia, Sana Staros will be in it, as will Aphra's two lunatic droids, her Wookiee bounty hunter friend, and a bunch of other characters. And there's not really any plot details at this point, but obviously I'm going to be getting the Star Wars title. Doing a crossover, that's the number one way to get people to buy a title that they weren't previously interested in. Just cross them over into the same story.
I mean, you don't have to get the rest of Aphra. I mean, if it ends up being, maybe two, if three at most, of Aphra, at least temporarily, they'll get you to buy the series.
Oh, yeah, they'll definitely do that. And I imagine at some point I'll buy Aphra and trade. I'm hearing enough good buzz about it that I'll probably cave in and buy it.
Yeah, and they come out pretty quickly. After an arc, the trades, I think, come out pretty quick.
Yeah, and I just prefer it. I mean, I now have issues 27 and 28 just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read either of those issues yet. And I haven't read Darth Maul number one. Have you checked that out?
No, not yet. I got to go to the store to pick up my my pull list. I'm actually looking back at my desk right now, and I have a nice pile of of comics I still got to get to.
Yep, mine is I've got about a 4-inch pile of comics that I've yet to read. It's catching up on me again.
Oh, I might even be double that. Like I might see those 4 inches in Rasia.
Oh boy. Well, I think Corey's got his beat. I'm sure he's got a foot and a half. he's spent a ton of money in the last little while on virtually every Star Wars comic that's been made in the new canon, and I don't know if he's read any of them.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm just talking Star Wars and maybe a few that's on my pull list. I still have like a stack of trades too I need to get through.
Yeah, I've got a few of those on order. I find here we are tangenting way off course, but I read a couple titles from Image, and I love Image comics for the uniqueness they bring.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you read?
Saga and East of West.
How is East of West?
I love it. I just love it. It's if you're familiar with Jonathan Hickman, I was buying these issues monthly, so I have like the first 16 or 18 issues. But with Jonathan Hickman, he plays such a intricate long game that I find like monthly, by the time the second issue comes out, you've got to go back and read issues 1 and 2, or read issue 1 again, then 2. Mm-hmm. And then when 3 comes out, you've got to go back and read 1 and 2 again, and then 3. So it took me a while, but I eventually stopped buying it monthly and opted for trades. I'm happier that way.
I'm starting to wish I did trades with the Star Wars ones, only because I'm starting to realize that eventually I'm going to run out of space for all the single issues.
And, that's an important consideration. I mean, I got back into comics about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, whenever they started with the New 52. That's what pulled me back in.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly then got pulled back into Marvel, and that's when I discovered Image. And I've got no space left. I've got like 4 or 5 long boxes full, which is, I know, a laughable amount by serious collector standards, but that's still a decent chunk of space in a house that is already having the walls closing around me.
Right. I mean, you got kids and their stuff, and it's a lot.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to unload some stuff soon that I know I won't read again. Mm. And I know I'll get pennies on the dollar for it, but, sometimes just the free space is worth its weight in gold.
It's true. And if it's a story you really like, you could always sell the single issues and just put that towards the trade, which is something that some people might do.
Yeah. I mean, I know I'll probably hang on to a lot of my variant covers or issue number ones just in case something special ever happens with them.
Right, right.
And certain arcs I will hang on to. But otherwise, goodbye.
Right, exactly. I mean, I have, I know one variant I definitely want to hold on to. I was in Disney World, and they had a Disney World exclusive Vader down number one.
Nice.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. So I was like, make sure I got that. So definitely not going to get rid of that one. But I don't know. I don't know. With some of the Star Wars ones, I'm thinking, I don't know. Well, actually, I was also wondering, because Marvel, they changed up their digital comics deal. It used to be you bought an issue and you got the comic with it, the digital. And now they're swapping it out. And instead of getting the comic you bought, you just get three random comics that they're trying to promote for the month. Ooh. So, yeah, kind of it's a real bummer. Because what I would...
You know what? Tim and Troy were talking about that on the Nerd Room.
I think that's where I heard it. Yep.
Yeah, they weren't pleased with that either. And yeah, that's kind of a jerk move. I mean, there's one way for them to couch it and say, we're giving you three free comics that you haven't read, but...
Right, it's like series I don't really want to pick up. I mean, I'm very specific when it comes to my comics. You know, I know the series I want, and I very rarely add one. So it's like, I don't really want these random comics, you know? Because especially with a collector, like, you know, you have them, you don't really want to keep going to the single issue because you feel like you're going to kind of wear it out. You kind of want to read it once, put it away, and then if I want to reread it, I'll just, you know, go on my iPad and pull up the Marvel app and just read it that way.
Yeah, I mean, God loves Squirrel Girl and Fantastic Four, but right now they're just not making the grade. I don't have the time, money, space, bandwidth to check all these things out. Like you, I'm super laser targeted on the books I want to read right now.
Right.
All right, so let's talk about Tarkin, Mr. Will Huff Tarkin. You know, I think we chose this book especially on the heels of Catalyst and Rogue One. This book kind of dovetails nicely with the events from the book and movie. So Tarkin sets up the main storyline is 5 years after the events of Revenge of the Sith, where the Senate is basically one giant yes man to the Emperor. The Outer Rim worlds have been kind of deserted by the Empire and left to fend for themselves. And we find Tarkin, who's I think he's a governor at that point. He's not been promoted or elevated to Grand Moff just yet. He's parked out in Tatooine, out by Tatooine and Geonosis by the Empire, and he's there guarding their super secret project, which was then called the Deep Space Mobile Battle Station, but we know it better as the Death Star. And it was made pretty clear that, you know, the closer you were to the core while in service of the Empire, the more important, the more prestigious you were. So Tarkin's assignment way out in the Outer Rim, for many, they perceived Tarkin as maybe a kind of outcast or not in the Emperor's good graces. But instead, it was quite the opposite, that the Empire held him in such good esteem that he was able to entrust this massive project, this massive undertaking to Tarkin himself.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about that is, you know, we get a lot of Tarkin's backstory and really why he's held with such regard in the Empire. You know, growing up on Eriadu, is that how you say it?
Exactly. I got confused between Eriadu and Edu.
You know what? One. What's so funny about that was as I was kind of refreshing all the information from Tarkin, because it's been a little while since I read it, I was like, wait a minute, Eriadu, was that in Rogue One? And so I was like, wait, and then I realized Edu, Eriadu, very close in name.
Really close, uncomfortably close.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, then it got me thinking, it was like, that might have been a missed opportunity. I'm thinking that would have been really cool to have Tarkin's home world in the film, because it would have felt even more full circle. Because like you said, like the reason why we decided to go back to this novel for this episode was that it just fits so perfectly with Catalyst in Rogue One. And it really kind of is all part of the rise of Tarkin. You know, we kind of see him ascend kind of throughout all three stories. Which would be very interesting if we got a little bit of his homeworld in Rogue One. But I digress. They probably would have distracted from the main story.
Yeah, that too. And also that it makes the galaxies feel smaller than it should.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we always say Star Wars is a big galaxy. And then, on the other hand, we say, it's a small galaxy. Because everybody knows everybody, or everybody's related to somebody we already know, and it's weird that way. I find it a curious decision to title the two planets in such a similar way.
Right.
But you know, really early in the book, there was a really funny call out, and I fans who pay attention to the making of A New Hope and some of the stories that came out of that movie. Early in the book, there's Tarkin. And he's with his tailor droid, who's putting together a new suit for him. And damn it, Tarkin just wants boots that fit. That made me laugh out loud. Because as we all kind of know, Peter Cushing famously wore slippers on set. So you never see Tarkin in boots in A New Hope. And I'm not even sure. I think they may have carried that through in Rogue One, but I can't quite remember.
Right.
Yeah, and I liked how Tarkin made a point of saying he just wants boots that fit. Like, even in this universe, Tarkin can't find a comfortable pair of boots.
I mean, that just goes to show how knowledgeable James Luceno is, that he's making such callbacks to things like that.
Oh, yeah, this guy knows Star Wars through and through.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this book, like I said, it takes place 5 years after Revenge of the Sith, but it does flash back and way back to Tarkin's youth. I mean, we're talking about Tarkin as like a 10 or 11-year-old, where he's still a naive boy. I don't think uncomfortable is the right word. But to see this guy in a very humanized way, where he's just a boy, and he's being raised among this family of definitely they're elites from their world, and they're kind of ruthless. Yeah. is for lack of a better word, cutthroat's not the right word, but definitely they view life as one big business transaction, where they have to kind of. You do what you got to do to climb the ladder, and it's you see that Tarkin is slowly, the little boy is slowly bred out of him, and as part of his upbringing and coming of age, Tarkin has to take these trips, and he's taken out into the wilderness by his great uncle, and you know there's hunting involved and. Killing and just surviving amidst the elements, and these expeditions were designed to take this boy and turn him into a hardened survivor, and there was a long sequence that described Tarkin's adventures in the wilderness, and it basically burned out what was left of his boyhood innocence, you know, through killing wildlife to feed and to defend themselves, starving, fatigue, exhaustion, cold, all that stuff. You slowly saw the little boy just gone.
Something that kind of struck me while reading Tarkin, while not explicitly, it seemed to parallel a little bit of Vader's experience. Did you get that a little bit? We have Tarkin as a boy. We also got Anakin as a boy. Very different worlds and personal experiences, but it is interesting that we get that relationship between the two. And we saw both of them go from those, you know, naive, innocent children, whether hardened through a militaristic family, or through Anakin, you know, being saved from slavery and dealing with the Jedi Order and all, you know, all that stuff, and being manipulated. But, you know, he was turned in a different way. Did you pick up on any of that?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, we see Anakin in The Phantom Menace as just this totally benevolent, good little kid. And there seemed to be some of that goodness in Tarkin as well. He mentions that he, you know, had a willingness to serve their servant if you know, if his parents had asked him to, or if the servant needed something. Young Wilhuff, you know, made it clear that he would do it just because he viewed the servant as a member of their family. And his parents are like, no, Tarkin will ever serve the servant, something like to that effect.
Right. And it seems, yeah. And it just seems that the author and just Star Wars at large just, you know, makes a point that there's like an inherent goodness, in children, and through whatever experience, that goodness can be, distorted, manipulated, and changed for a bigger purpose.
Absolutely, yeah. He was trained. I mean, once he started doing those expeditions, it was all about training to be ruthless, disciplined, and dominating whatever it is that's in front of you, whether it's nature or people. It was all about being the dominant figure by the end of the day.
Right. And then obviously we get the tie-in to his ship, the Star Destroyer Carrion Spike. You know, that was named after the Carrion. Was it the location was called Carrion Spike, or did he change it a little bit for the ship? I forget.
I forget too, but yeah, there was sort of a spike on the plateau, which I think carried over to the name. And interesting, the ship, if you think back to the Clone Wars, if you remember the arc, I think it was during the Christophsis battle, Anakin was piloting that really long, narrow, pointy, it was basically, I think it may have been sort of a take on an early concept of the Millennium Falcon, but don't quote me on that. But that ship is pretty much what the Carrion Spike looked like, from my understanding.
Okay.
And it's funny because in the same book, Admiral Trench's ship from the Christophsis arc was referenced, which is a nice little callback for Clone Wars fans.
Oh. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the Christophsis battle, so I'm kind of just looking at some images. It was Anakin's ship?
I can't remember what the ship was called anymore. But it was a long, skinny ship with a pointy nose, and it had a cloaking capability. And I think Tarkin's Carrion Spike was essentially that.
Okay.
The first three chapters of the book, they surround this mysterious attack on Imperial bases in the Outer Rim. And, of course, Tarkin is then thrust into the position of sort of the chief investigator. But it served to highlight his brilliance in the way he's able to deduce things and break down his enemy's moves and their tactics and their motives for doing things.
Yeah, for sure. He, you know, they do a really good job at, I guess, highlighting and emphasizing what we already knew of Tarkin in A New Hope. And now Catalyst, you know, we really get a sense of, you know, why he has the merits that he does. And what do we call him? Jimmy L last time? yeah, Jimmy L just does a really good job at, painting that picture of how smart Tarkin is. You know, calling those shots. And like you said, deducing, he's almost like the Sherlock of the Empire in a way.
Yeah, definitely.
You know? So I love
Which
that.
Is funny because didn't Peter Cushing also play Sherlock Holmes?
He did play Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock.
Okay.
And
close enough.
Yeah, and he played him in a TV movie of The Great Houdini, which was a bio drama.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So something else I'd found pretty interesting. So throughout Tarkin's life, right through his teens and into his, from that time I would imagine his early 20s, he had never even seen a Jedi and knew little of them. And so when he finally came to encounter them, I want to say it was on Coruscant, he was fascinated by what he assumed were their metaphysical powers. But he wanted to see how they dealt with disagreement, because Tarkin's way was clearly different than the Jedi way. And you could see how eventually Anakin, Vader, came to despise the Jedi because they didn't use the Force to its fullest extent. Tarkin felt the same way, that the Jedi were just, they were too weak, too soft.
Right, they were holding themselves back, and that's not how Tarkin operated.
No, it was, for Tarkin, it was, completely crush your enemies. And you do what you need to do to crush them. Whereas the Jedi, of course, had their rules and their dogma, and they would tackle things in other ways. But on the note of Jedi, Tarkin suspected, it's funny because we've had this, I think it was in Bloodline that they make mention of it. Who actually knew that Vader was Anakin Skywalker? And I think very few people knew that. And I'm not sure if they mentioned it in Bloodline, but somewhere along the way, I remember seeing that it was a question mark whether or not Tarkin even knew. But he in the book, it was clear that he suspected it.
Mm-hmm.
And later on in the book, he came to just assume that, yeah, that's Anakin Skywalker.
Right. They definitely cleared it up in the novel. I think, I can't remember if they brought that up in Bloodline. Because the central question was, who is Vader's kids? But I don't remember if Anakin was mentioned by name. But at least here, that we kind of get, we finally get the understanding that Tarkin does, for the most part, know.
Yeah. Yeah, he was smart enough to see the similarities between the two. And yeah, I think it's safe to assume that Tarkin had figured it out on his own. There was one sequence in the book before Tarkin had joined the Empire. I think he was sort of I forget his title. I forget who he was working for, but sector security was more or less his job, as I remember it. And there was this group of bandits that Tarkin had a hard time with, but eventually he captured them. And his punishment for them, and remember, this is a young man doling out this punishment, but he programmed their ship to fly into the solar system's sun, right, while a video feed was streamed to her colleagues, who watched this ship kind of fly towards the sun and watched their friends inside burn up. I was like, man, that's grisly. There's that training for you, the ruthless training, and sending a message to everybody else that you better not mess with Tarkin.
Right. That's intense. And it's kind of a Thrawn level, at least from what I could think. I mean, I don't know how Thrawn was in the Legends stuff. I don't know if he was that intense with his executions.
I don't remember, to be honest with you. It's been 25 years since I read those books.
Well, at least from the sense that I get from fans, the way they talk about Thrawn and how, intense he's supposed to be and how much of a threat he's supposed to be. It seems like a quality that might be there, similar.
On the topic of Thrawn, do you think there's room in the Empire for Tarkin and Thrawn
to coexist?
Does it seem like they're too close? Like the character is too close to the same thing.
So the moral of kind of what the Empire that I'm getting is, the reason why the Empire fails is kind of what we saw with Krennic and Tarkin. It's susceptible to everyone's egos. So I think, you know, Thrawn and Tarkin trying to coexist, they would bump heads. They would disagree. And I feel like it would end up being a power play. Now, did you mean could they coexist, or you meant that just the characters are way too similar?
I guess both. Both are, I think, valid discussion points.
The characters are very similar, so I think trying, just as a fan and a viewer or a reader or whatever medium it ends up being, if they were to kind of try to do missions together, it might be too repetitive because they are very similar. But at the same time, like I was saying, I think the two of them could power play just as Krennic and Tarkin did. So that would be interesting. And was it confirmed that Tarkin is going to be in the Thrawn novel, or?
I've not seen that. It wouldn't shock me for sure to see Tarkin in there.
What I would love to see is, I would love to see Tarkin have a decent role in the novel, because then we would get a really cool progression. Because right now, I'm dubbing Tarkin, Catalyst, and Rogue One kind of like the Imperial trilogy, in a way. Because I feel like those three stories flow so perfectly together.
Absolutely, and I think you can even, to a certain degree, throw Lost Stars in there.
Yeah. It really just creates such a rich picture of the Empire. So for Thrawn to be put in the mix, and if Tarkin was there, it would just further develop the new canon that they're building around the Empire.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, we're getting a good long look inside the inner workings of the Empire. I mean, throughout all these books, and Rogue One gave us another good look. Yeah, I mean, compared to what just 2-3 years ago, we know way more about the Empire now. Back on the Jedi, just for a second here. I was always puzzled as to how the Jedi faded into myth so quickly, and how the galaxy kind of just turned on them so quickly. And it, as we've come to learn through all these books, and again, it's sort of reinforced here in Tarkin, because the Senate was such a collective yes man to Palpatine, they bought whatever he said. So when he told the Senate in Revenge of the Sith that the Jedi had a plot to assassinate him and overthrow the galaxy and take over, they believed him. And so the Jedi being traitors and villains is almost like a commonly accepted thing in the galaxy now.
Right. It's just interesting to see how that develops so quickly into the Jedi becoming myth around, you know, because I feel like, and this has kind of been debated, I think, just how quickly the Jedi kind of fleeted from public consciousness. But yeah, I agree. You know, since he was so manipulative of the Senate, you know, it was definitely easy to propel that narrative.
Yeah, and like we talked about a couple weeks ago in the propaganda book, it was the Jedi were kind of almost the architects of their own demise because of the way they kind of recoiled. I mean, obviously they lived in that big opulent palace on Coruscant, but anywhere else, you know, it was hard to come across a Jedi. So most people would live their life without seeing a Jedi or knowing what they do. They'd mm-hmm. only hear things about them. So once the Empire took over and eradicated the Jedi and painted them as villains, and of course Sidious and the Empire took over the Jedi Temple and used it for their own purposes, they really made short work of the Jedi legacy. So it becomes, even though I don't fully buy it, and it seems a little convenient, you see why the Jedi were kind of mythical figures in The Force Awakens, which is really just, you know, 30, 40 years after all the events of the original trilogy.
Right. Right. And I mean, really, I mean, if we apply it to kind of our own existence, I mean, I was born in 90, and, you know, to think things that happened 30, 40 years prior to my birth, I mean, some, you know, that's stuff I learned in, history books, and I'm sure some stuff was forgotten. Not everything's included in the school curriculum, so things do get forgotten over time. And I mean, especially in a galaxy that large, you know.
Well, and especially under an empire that
purposely snuffs it. Yeah,
rewrote the history books according to their own whims. So if they wanted the Jedi to be evil, the Jedi were evil, and people bought it.
Exactly. Exactly. And just go, it really just shows you how far reaching and precise the Empire was.
Yeah, they just dominated everything. We see a lot of that in this. I mean, actually, you know what? You don't quite get that much of the Empire's dominance in this book. They had yet to really solidify their grip on everything.
Right.
I mean, the Empire is still a relatively new thing by this point. Taking a step back here, we've learned about the origin of Palpatine and Tarkin's relationship, and it takes place pre-Phantom Menace, where Palpatine more or less buys Tarkin's loyalty by offering to vouch for him as I think Tarkin wanted to enter some sort of judicial academy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Palpatine was more or less saying, no, you're too good for that. I'll vouch for you if you want, but... He kind of buttered him up in a scene that was really reminiscent for me of the Anakin Palpatine scene from the opera in The Revenge of the Sith. And that scene put a smile on my face. I liked Lucino's take on that in a Palpatine Tarkin sense.
Yeah, I mean, you could see Palpatine, you know, he really knew how to move the pieces. And when he saw someone like Tarkin or Anakin, young, new in the fields that they were in, you know, he was able to kind of move in and plant those seeds and start to manipulate them and move them where he needed them to be.
Yeah, and it was like just so far in advance. Like Palpatine was working on this plan of taking over for years and years and years before it actually came to fruition. Yeah, that takes a lot of patience, man.
He was playing the long game for sure.
Oh, man. There's no doubt about that. But I think the main plot of the book, the one that underscores Tarkin and his strategic mind, is after his ship, the Carrion Spike, is stolen by some for lack of a better term, we're going to call them rebels. His ship is heisted on. Oh, geez, I forget what planet now. Mercana.
Mercana. Yeah, like something with an M. I know.
Yeah, Mercana. So yeah, these guys lift his ship, and most of the rest of the book is focused on Tarkin and Vader chasing the Carrion Spike across the galaxy, and I thought that plot line carried on a bit too much. Like they kept getting away from Tarkin and Vader, and I for a while I was like, wait, aren't you guys the smartest of all and the most badass of all? Why is it taking you so long to catch these guys? They keep getting away. Did you have that same feeling?
Right. It seemed to kind of, yeah, it seemed to drag a little bit. And it just kind of kept going from like A to B, back to A, back to B, and kind of just zigzagging. So yeah, I tend to agree.
Yeah, and it was at this part of the book where, you know, we've met many of the Imperial faces that we've met in the past. So I think Tag is in this book, and Maudie is in this book. Admiral Yularen from Clone Wars is in the book. A bunch of familiar names, and there's a lot of banter. It's I think it's well written. But I kind of lost my way in this book. I'm starting to learn more about myself when it comes to this new canon where, for the most part, I just want the info. Like I would have been happy reading the Coles notes of this book and just walking away with the takeaways. It's not a bad book, but it's very dialogue-driven.
It's more character-heavy. You know, it's a little more, yeah, it is drawn out. And, I mean, it's good if you want to get a sense of, you know, of Tarkin himself. But as far as excitement and the kind of the overall arc of the story, Yeah, not too much there. It's not very plot heavy.
No, I mean, there's Tarkin and Vader chasing a ship, and on the other end, there's Palpatine, and he's trying to unravel, in his own special way, who the mole is on the Imperial side, feeding the rebels information.
Mm-hmm.
One of the surprising things I've thought about this book is that Darth Vader gets a ton of dialogue, and it all felt very weird to me. Like, I think Vader is always most effective when he's more, it's almost like a less is more thing with Vader, mm-hmm. but he got a lot of dialogue in this book.
Yeah. I mean, have you read Lords of the Sith yet?
Not yet, but I imagine you'll.
Okay. You'll get there. Yeah. That'll feel weird too.
You know, I don't envy James Luceno for having to write that, because he doesn't have there's a ton to go on with Vader as far right. as how he speaks. I guess there's enough, and for a talented writer like Luceno, he can make it work. But man, a lot of the dialogue just felt like Vader was babbling too much.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Vader does work best when he's a little more stoic, you know, not as long-winded. But I mean, it was still at least interesting to see, you know, the dynamic between him and Tarkin, and it plays as a nice prelude to A New Hope, jumping into their interactions there.
Yeah. But, I mean, we see when Palpatine first puts them together and wants them to kind of work out their differences, I mean, differences in philosophies, more or less, mm-hmm. and learn how to work together, because obviously Palpatine knows these two are going to be tied at the hip to a certain degree going forward. So, it was. Can we draw any parallels between the relationship between Vader and Tarkin and Anakin and Obi-Wan? Was there any kind of parallel to be made there?
I mean, is there something that you noticed? Is that why you're asking?
No, not really. Just throwing a question to you, seeing if you had thought of anything.
I mean, less of a mentorship. It was really more of a partnership. Dynamic.
Yeah,
you're
right.
I mean,
I think, there was a mutual respect for each other's roles.
Yeah. But I mean, it was, but what's interesting, at least, though, is there was the difference of philosophy. You know, Anakin, had his, and Obi-Wan had his, and obviously that eventually led to the demise of that relationship. But what's interesting, at least with Tarkin and Vader, is that they were still able to, like you said, they had that mutual respect, and they were still able to work together towards a common goal, despite differences in philosophy. And I guess the difference there is with Anakin and Obi-Wan, the end game for the two of them was different, whereas Tarkin and Vader want the same things for the Empire. So there's a little more of an agreement there.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
I feel like I was rambling a little bit, but if that makes sense, thumbs up.
No, I think that does make sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Obi-Wan seemed to always be trying to keep Anakin on track, whereas, yeah, Vader and Tarkin seem to always be more or less pulling in the same direction.
Yeah.
So the book references atrocities that Vader had committed since the end of the war. And it was done in the context of destroying that fuel tanker. So I'm wondering, like, what the hell did Vader do in those? Of course, nobody knows what the answer is, but it sounds like Vader did some really bad stuff in the post-Revenge of the Sith years.
Right, and I think we're all kind of waiting on pins and needles for that to be illustrated in some way.
Yeah, I wonder if we're ever going to get that.
I think we're all craving it, at least for sure. But if we're going to get it, it might be a different story.
Yeah, it could be something that just I feel like Vader is almost going to go on ice for a while at some point.
Right. I mean, I feel like they gave him his moment to shine in Rogue One. Obviously with these novels, but now that the Vader comics have kind of bowed out, yeah, I mean, they might be starting to move away from him. But you never know.
Yeah, I mean, there might be a little bit more Vader in episode 8 or 9. But it feels like Vader might go away for a little while. And maybe if they do bring him back, it's you know, Vader hunting down the last of the Jedi, which would be a nice return for the character. But I feel like that's a ways off.
Right. I think down the line, I think they're eager to develop kind of the new mythos and the new characters and kind of start to, you know, bolster kind of the sequel trilogy era. You know, because I feel like the last, at least since The Force Awakens, all of the novels, all of the comics have really kind of been OT era, you know, between prequel and original. So they're kind of been going back. And I think once episode 8 premieres, I think we're going to start moving forward a little more.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope we start moving away from this era a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of, I mean, we're not done with Tarkin yet, but remind me, we got to go through my poll that I ran.
Right, hopefully remember that before before the end of the show.
I'm going to just jot a note so I don't forget.
All right, so there was one, I mean, I'm not going to lie, this book almost lost me at a couple different points. And one of the points where it almost did was when Tarkin was telling Vader about, it was more or less his last mission. I think it was his last mission on the plateau on Iriadu. And it went on for page after page. And I was having trouble getting through it. And I was like, oh, just wrap up your story. I can only imagine Darth Vader standing there next to you, listening to you talk for probably 20 minutes.
Right. And,
like, I can imagine, like, Darth Vader doesn't have a whole lot of patience, and he's always got something important to attend to, at least in his own mind, right? And he's listening to Tarkin just go on and on and on for page after page.
20 minutes, like, and he's ready to force choke Tarkin, you know?
Yeah, it was like, am I supposed to believe that Vader's going to sit there and listen to this? Oh my god, like I want to kill Tarkin now. What does Vader want to do? He wants to run him through with his lightsaber.
It did make me realize kind of the mediums through which Vader is best illustrated. And I think while I like delving into the stories in the novels, he really is best as a visual character.
Absolutely.
So I think whether through comics, animation, or the live action, I think Vader just kind of comes across best, because he isn't a man of many words. He is more stoic, so, you know, it's harder to in prose write about his actions when there is no dialogue. It's better to just see it, like a show don't tell kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, that is, I think, some of the weaknesses in the written part of canon.
So yeah, the I mean, the only way I could rationalize that to myself was that Vader was listening to Tarkin talk about his expeditions with his uncles and his family life, and that Vader was almost having a moment to himself, sort of listening to this person talk about a family that he never had. I was like, that's the only way, this is the only way I can rationalize Vader listening to this.
Right. Like, there's a part of the longing that's still there.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's maybe reading too much into it, because Vader's not supposed to feel those things until Luke brings it out of him.
Mm.
But I don't know. Maybe there are little tiny flickers of it here and there in the that in Vader's life that would allow him to say, oh, I had such a miserable upbringing.
I mean, I think it would be a disservice to the character if, you know, we don't assume that there's more than just the two dimensions. You know, I mean, he's not, I mean, while he is kind of the ruthless Vader that we know, and Luke, you know, breaks through to him, but there still has to be those kind of cracks in the walls already in order for Luke to break through.
Yeah.
You know, there has
absolutely,
to,
for sure.
Yeah, because villains are rarely one dimensional. So, and, you know, it still has to be there. So.
Yeah, and there was mention a couple times in the book where Palpatine wanted to find a way just to crush the light. There was, like, the Force always had a way of, I can't remember how they phrased it, but he wanted to use the dark side just to stamp out all light. He could never do it, and really no Sith ever could. And that was one of his goals. And it just made you think, well, yeah, that last one flicker of light that was left in Anakin / Vader ended up being your downfall. There's a slick little reference to that there. But speaking of Palpatine's goals, just when I was about ready to bail out of the book, or maybe I was past the point of no return, we get an interesting section about Palpatine's actual goals. And while, you know, ruling the galaxy as emperor and having everybody at your service is wonderful, it mentions how, you know, he never really cared for all the trappings of luxury that was showered upon him, as even as senator and as supreme chancellor, and certainly as emperor. It was nice. They were all nice to haves, but he didn't care about them. His real work, of course, was, you know, he defined in the dark side. And the book mentions that, you know, at this particular time in the timeline, Palpatine's foresight was not yet perfect, and he still had a lot to learn. But his big goal is that he wanted to unlock dark side powers that ancient Sith before him, and I guess that would include his master Plagueis, were unable to achieve. And specifically, he wanted the power to reshape reality itself and to create a universe of his own creation. And he wasn't seeking immortality, but some kind of everlasting influence. And it's like, Jesus, this guy just wants to be, he wants to be a god.
Right. Big dreams.
ambitious guy.
Ambitious. No, it's crazy to think, because that, as far as Star Wars goes, I mean, that is the deep end that we haven't quite read yet or gotten yet. You know, that is insanity on a level that Star Wars hasn't really seen. Like, we've had our villains, and, you know, and, you know, we've had the Emperor part of the canon for a long time, but to have it put in that perspective is so different. It almost feels un-Star Wars like.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Not that I don't like, I mean, I like it. But it almost doesn't seem like it's a motive that fits Star Wars, you know, at first glance. But after thinking about it for some time and kind of letting it sink, I dig it. But are you having trouble accepting it, or do you?
I am. Absolutely, yeah. I am. You know, I always assumed that, you know, through all his machinations in the prequels and growing up as a kid, seeing this wrinkly raisin of a human on his throne, I always thought, well, that's his goal. He wanted to rule the galaxy. And here we are finding out that, whatever, I'm emperor, fine. But really, I want to reshape reality. And I feel like a little bit like I've had the rug pulled out from under me. Like, if that was your goal, if you want to just worry about the dark side and practice and get closer to the dark side until you can bend reality to your will, why don't you just do that? You don't need to be emperor to do that. Can't you just go live somewhere on Mustafar and rot in your castle and just flirt with the dark side day and night until you can achieve your goal? Like, why do you need to be bothered with, you know, political affairs?
I suppose it makes it easier for harvesting like resources, in the sense that because he's emperor, he was able to say, get on Jeddah and get into those temples and get the Kyber crystals, and it kind of gives you a further reach, and you have people kind of doing the work for you. Does that make sense? You know,
yeah,
I mean,
I see what you mean.
Yeah, so like, you know, if say the Empire discovers a temple, they'll report it to him, and he can go learn things at that temple. You know,
so yeah, I guess maybe that's part of it. I just felt like, well, because a couple of times in the book, it was mentioned how annoyed he was that he was always being pulled back into these mundane affairs when he's got other stuff to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, you don't have to do this. You could just go. You don't need to be the emperor to dabble in the dark side. I guess if being emperor gave you access to Jedi archives and places that you can only get to by being someone high on the totem pole, so you can learn more, okay, I guess. But yeah, I feel like that was a left hook that caught me right on the chin. Because I think that was almost the biggest takeaway for me out of the whole book.
That's true. Because it really just reshapes just broad concepts of the Star Wars universe. The fact that someone could potentially do this, which then makes you wonder, I mean, if this is just going to be a throwaway thing, or is Lucas Story Group, easing us into this idea that it's possible? And is this in fact something that, say, Snoke, for example, if this is something that he wants to do?
Yeah.
Interesting question.
Is he picking up Palpatine's legacy?
Right. You know, this whole finish what you started kind of thing. Where Kylo and Vader, you know, it's a different kind of, you know, thing that he's finishing. But, you know, that whole theory that Snoke is, you know, the secret student of Vader, which is, I've been hearing kind of throughout the Commonwealth, and I think you guys talked about it on your last show, right? Or possibly, I forget.
I forget too.
So many Commonwealth shows that it's
I just
hard
host
to keep
the show. I don't commit any of it to memory.
But it's based on the video game The Force Unleashed, which I haven't played. I have it, but I haven't had a chance to play it yet.
Oh, no, you're right. That's right. That was in reference to Ezra.
Yeah, that Ezra might be the new, you know, he might be an apprentice to Vader.
Yeah.
But Snoke could be, you know, regardless of Ezra, you know, it could be someone else who has been a secret apprentice to Vader. But anyway, it could be someone who's kind of picked up on the Emperor's knowledge, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, you kind of begin to wonder, you know, a lot of this, there's purpose to everything that they reveal. And I doubt that they're putting together these details just for, like, throwaway lines in, like, a standalone novel. You know, you have to see if they're painting a bigger picture.
Yeah. All these seeds for things that will get revisited in one form or another.
Exactly. So it's definitely something to kind of keep in mind, whether it's, you know, moved over to the films or other stuff.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Just a couple other things before we finish up with Tarkin. We see Tarkin in a couple scenarios where you almost feel like he's a fish out of water. Like there's a point in the book where he's piloting a starfighter, and he was sort of not even second fiddle, but you know, Vader was taking the lead in that capacity, and I think the book made it pretty clear that Tarkin is obviously at his best when he's left alone with his brain to figure things out. So he's kind of taken off the job of finding the rebels who stole his ship. You know, he's taken sort of out of the field of play and almost like put behind a desk and told to, you know, figure it out this way. You know, and almost by the Emperor himself. And some people kind of thought that he was in the Emperor's bad books, but it was the Emperor realizing what Tarkin's strength was. So if, you know, once Tarkin was finally, I guess, put in a position to succeed, he quickly got to the bottom of finding the identities of the people that stole the ship. And then he, of course, they track them down. There's a space battle. I think the Carrion Spike is destroyed or at least lost. But anyway, Tarkin and Vader win their battle. They capture the rebels. And we get to the end of the book. And earlier on, when Tarkin had suggested that, you know, famously we hear it in A New Hope, where regional governors will kind of manage their sector of space, and that's how the Empire will maintain control. And Palpatine at this point is impressed enough with Tarkin that he grants him his wish and makes him the Empire's first Grand Moff, who's in charge of the Outer Rim, which includes full control of the Death Star project. And for me, the obvious takeaway there is that if he's put Tarkin in full control of the Death Star project, then poor Krennic was a pawn the entire time. So even though, you know, in Catalyst and even in Rogue One, where at times you might have been inclined to believe that Krennic, yeah, he did maintain control. It was his baby. It never was.
Yeah, you know, in hindsight, it's true. It really makes Krennic more of a bit of a tragic character. Kind of always set up to fail in that sense.
Yeah, a total pawn.
Yeah.
He was a total pawn. He was never going to get anywhere with Tarkin and the Emperor, ever. He was an outsider from the start, and they used Krennic for all his talents of manipulation and his own level of smarts to get the Death Star project finished. And then he was disposed of very, very quickly and abruptly.
Something else that I found very interesting, you know, after Tarkin was made Moff and put in charge of the Death Star, we also get this thing called the Tarkin Doctrine, which, based on, I guess there was a media, publication, and it became the Imperial Military Doctrine. So what was to become the Empire was kind of based on, I guess, Tarkin's own philosophies.
Yeah. Yeah, and not only was Tarkin sort of a legendary figure by the end of the book within Imperial ranks, but in the galaxy, among the populace, he was now this legendary figure within the Empire. Parades in his honor and this and that. It was quite the ascension for Tarkin in this book.
Yeah.
And if, you know, at the very end, we get a tour of the Death Star in its relatively early stages. You know, they make it clear that it's still very far from being finished, but it's still, as Lucino is describing it, it all sounds very familiar. And that part dovetails perfectly with Catalyst.
Exactly. And just kind of quickly, you know, speaking of the Death Star, I just want to note the artwork on the book. I don't know who illustrated it. But if you like, the front cover is very simple. You have Tarkin and Vader, but the back, I love the shot of Tarkin in the Death. Oh no, in his ship, looking at the Death Star. Which I assume, you know, might take place towards the end of the book. But just a side note, I thought it was really beautiful work.
Yeah, you know, I don't have that because the copy of the book that I have is the compilation with A New Dawn.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Was the Empire's something?
Of the Empire.
Rise of the Empire. Okay.
So it's funny because you have Kanan and Hera on the top portion of the book, and on the bottom of the book, it's a picture of Vader, even though it's got novels. It's got Tarkin and A New Dawn in it. I got a picture of Vader.
That's
goes to show, Darth always sells. Put him on the cover.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I don't think we're done with him yet, even though they might put him on ice for a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't think they'll ever fully be done with him.
Yeah, they may not be able to be ever fully done with him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it for the book. It wasn't my favorite book. I'll just put my cards on the table. I did enjoy learning more about Tarkin as someone who's, I guess, more or less a secondary character. But an important one nonetheless. Seeing how his input served the Empire and made the Empire what it was and what we come to know as movie fans. I appreciated all that. And getting insights into the Empire, into Palpatine and Vader. I think it was a useful book. I had a lot of, actually, you know what? In the end, I switched to the audiobook.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was just reading the actual novel was taking me too long. So maybe a third of the way through, a quarter of the way through, I flipped over to the audiobook, and it's like 9.5 hours or so.
Right.
And it was much easier to bang out that way.
Yeah. And you know what? Like I was telling you earlier, I did read this a while ago, and now that I'm thinking about it, I forgot that I actually did put it down for a while, and took a break from it for a few weeks. I forget which part made me kind of put it down, and it was actually my first semester of grad school too, so things were just kind of busy anyway. But I ended up finishing it on a cruise. I had like a week vacation, and I was like, oh, I should just bring this, it'll give me a chance to. So I sat by the pool and finished it.
There you go.
But yeah, that was nice. But yeah, you know, it does drag in the middle, unfortunately, and it was a bit of a chore to get through. But like you said, I think it offers a lot of good tidbits, creates a bigger picture. It pairs very well, like we were saying, with Catalyst. So whether I don't know if I would recommend someone read it right before Catalyst, but I don't know. If the book was written a little differently, I'd say it could almost make a nice combo with Catalyst.
I guess you have to know who you're speaking to, I think. If it's somebody who you know is absolutely nuts about Star Wars and will read anything, yeah, I would say go ahead and read it because you're going to like it. If it's somebody who is a little bit more choosy and only wants to read the best of the best, I would say leave this one aside.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there's anything critical in this book.
As of now. You know what I mean? If the story group's playing the long game in 2020 down the line, maybe. That's what's interesting with the canon. It's like you never know if that piece of information is going to be important or not. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
You're right. Yeah, I mean, there's small little things. Like at that point of the timeline, it was actually a king on Naboo. I don't know if you remember that part, but there's no more queen on Naboo. It was a king. I was like, oh, look at that. That's interesting. And it could be one of those things that one day pops back into a storyline and go, oh, yeah, that's the king that was referenced in Tarkin way back when in 2014.
Right. Right. I mean, they have all this kind of, I imagine, a big Star Wars Bible of all the things that are being developed, so you never know what they're going to turn to and pick from. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, it was a good book. It just, there were parts that dragged. I feel like it could have been, 80 to 100 pages shorter.
Yeah.
But and again, that's probably not how the publishing business works. You have to hit a certain word count or page count, and that's just the way it is.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
Fill her up, James.
What was it, two? Well, actually, I mean, as far as the books go, it was relatively brisk. It's 200. The hardcover is like 274 pages, I want to say. Oh, no, 258.
Yeah, I guess that's not too bad.
Yeah. I guess with his writing style, and the fact that it wasn't super plot heavy, it didn't seem to roll like some of the other books had.
Yeah. Yeah, it just kind of plods along methodically. Mm-hmm. Like, which I guess is fitting of the Tarkin character. Things move along at a pace that has to... You have to give the characters time to unravel these things.
Yeah.
But certainly, learning about the upper echelon of the Empire, that's definitely worth it. Little connective things, interesting tidbits of, like, knowing that Palpatine and Vader had sort of commandeered the Jedi Temple for their own purposes. You know, there's scenes that take place, you know, the Jedi had their briefing room where they had that big 3D globe of the galaxy in Revenge of the Sith, I believe. That room is actually in the Tarkin novel, and you know, Palpatine's using it for his own ends at this point. Really cool stuff in that regard. But again, someone has to be really devoted to Star Wars and all the little tiny intricacies and minute details that make it what it is, make the new canon what it is, in order to really appreciate the book.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say this would be the first novel someone should check out if they're just getting into the canon.
Oh, no. This is not the place to start.
I've actually been recommending Catalyst as the first book for people, mostly because Rogue One is fresh in the public consciousness now. But I just think, you know, and most Star Wars fans have seen Rogue One now. Or
yeah, no,
that
Catalyst is a good. Yeah, Catalyst is a good start. It, yeah, there's likable characters. It's a easy to digest story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's tied directly into the movie, so it's a good point of reference. It's not obscure as far as the characters and the connections. So I think it serves a really good
jump definitely.
Off. So
before we wrap up, let's. I didn't forget. Let's talk about the poll that you ran on Twitter.
All right. Let me pull up my phone so I get to my Twitter. So for the first official Journals poll from my end, not too bad. 235 votes.
That's really good, man.
That's a good sample size. So
absolutely.
The question I posed was, which time period should the Star Wars canon focus more attention on? It could be comics, novels, TV shows, what have you. And the options that I gave were Old Republic, the beginning of the Jedi, between episodes 6 and 7, and the lead up to Phantom Menace. So anything right before episode 1. And with a resounding 55%, most people said the Old Republic, which I assume that that's probably what was going to win. Just gauging public opinion, fan opinion, that seems to be the era that most people long for based on Legends material, video game material.
Yeah, isn't that KOTOR people?
Yeah, Knights of the Old Republic, all those fans. So, very evident. In second, with only 24%, almost a quarter, more stuff between episodes 6 and 7. And then almost tied was Beginning of the Jedi and lead up to Phantom Menace with 11 and 10% respectively. So anything surprising? Are you surprised by those results?
I'm not surprised that Old Republic won. I didn't think it would win by such a landslide.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, 'cause my vote was Beginning of the Jedi. And I thought, you know, I thought between the Old Republic and between 6 and 7 and Beginning of the Jedi, I thought those would be more evenly split, and I figured leading into Phantom Menace, I thought that would be dead last. And it was certainly last, but by the slimmest of margins.
Right. Not by much.
No, I thought that would have been, you know, like 2%, whereas everybody else gets like 33, 31, and 30%, that kind of thing. And lead up to Phantom Menace gets the table scraps.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you. I expected everything else to be a little closer. I definitely expected Old Republic to come out on top. My own poll, I couldn't vote, but I was definitely between Old Republic. Even though I never read in any of the books or played through the entire Knights of the Old Republic, I just there's just something about, because what that's like, what, 1,000 years before, Phantom Menace.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting because it's familiar enough. You know, there's a structured government, but different enough where I feel like you can get some very interesting stories. But I would like to see more between episodes 6 and 7, only because we haven't really gotten too much yet. I mean, we got Bloodline, we're getting Aftermath, but not as much as far as our main core characters.
Yeah, and Empire's End is out in just a few days from now, about 2 weeks from now. And that'll complete a pretty good piece of the puzzle. But you're right, there's still a couple decades to explore in there. And you know what it is, though? It's that we want to see this time period through Luke's eyes. And that we're just not going to get that until, I would say, after episode 8, maybe even after episode 9.
Probably after 9, because you have to assume, like, what are they withholding as far as information goes? Because, I mean, anything that they show would probably spoil a lot of the central mysteries of the new trilogy anyway. You know, as far as who is Snoke and what is Luke doing and, you know, all that stuff that they want to answer in the movies. So, it definitely, the movies are kind of holding back the canon in that sense.
Yep. No doubt about that.
So
I assume, and maybe incorrectly, that before The Last Jedi comes out, that there will be some book or comic or something that will tease information from episode 8. And maybe I'm wrong. But for The Force Awakens, we had Journey to The Force Awakens, and Aftermath was sort of the flagship piece of that campaign. And mm-hmm. I haven't heard any kind of Journey to The Last Jedi yet, but I've got to assume something's going to come out of that.
I say we'll probably get announcements at Celebration.
Oh, yeah, Celebration. That thing that I'm not going to.
hey, you're not alone. I'm not going. I wish I was going. And it's unfortunate, too, because it's in Orlando, and it's not that hard for me to get to Florida. But it's just, I'm already going this month, and it's just crazy to get, you know. Plus, I'm trying to get a new job, and once, you know, starting a new job, then going on vacation, it's kind of hard.
Yeah,
kind of
hard
to do.
I hear you. Yeah, it's a big undertaking for sure.
One day I will go. I will make it a bucket list goal.
It's got to be on the list.
Yeah. Totally forgot where I was going with that, but
it's late, man. Nobody's going to hold it against you.
I know. I'm like, it's my head is just like, go to sleep. but. Just kind of going back to the poll. I mean, I'm as far as the choices I gave, I mean, I put them there because I wouldn't mind seeing stories in either of those eras. Really, I mean, I want to see stories take place, yeah, at the dawn of the Jedi, during the Old Republic, after episode 6. I mean, we're getting, with the Darth Maul comic, we're getting a lead up to Phantom Menace. So, I mean, there's just so much for them to explore.
And they will. We're gonna get stories in every single era. They're gonna shake us for every dime.
Uh huh.
It's just a matter of when.
You know, because I think with the excitement of the new canon and the new movies, I feel like, you know, we honestly spent the last two years in the same two eras, really. you know, the comics have mainly been between New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, and the novels have mainly been between 3 and 4.
Yep.
So those have kind of been the two in the last couple of years. So I feel like, and I don't think I'm the only one that's feeling it. You know, I'm feeling a little OT saturated. I'm getting a little, you know, fatigue with that era.
Yeah, I made mention of that in a episode of Tumbling Saber not too long ago. Just let's get out of this era. Let's get out of between 3 and 4. Or sorry, let's get out of A New Hope, Empire. Let's please, enough from this era. You've beaten it enough. Find something else.
Right. I mean, I think originally, I mean, it's obvious that they were going for the nostalgia and trying to get the older fans back and trying to get the new fans kind of familiar with that era. You know, they're trying to do multiple things, you know. So, yeah, it's definitely time, I think, to explore different, just different moments in time.
Yeah. And we're probably going to talk about that more as we move forward here. But I think for now, I think this is a good place to end this edition of Journals of the Willing.
Yeah, I think so.
Where can we find you on Twitter?
I am at JoangoFett.
Awesome. And I'm at Tumbling Saber. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, if that's your thing. And as for the Commonwealth, you can find all the shows at StarWarsCommonwealth.com, and that's Talk Star Wars, Generation X-Wing, The Nerd Room, The Skyhoppers, and The Rogue Squadron Podcast. And no point in beating around the bush. We'll be back in episode 62 of the Tumbling Saber Podcast in a few days from now. And wishing you all a very good weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber team, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Learn more about the network and its members at StarWarsCommonwealth.com.